Have you ever had the experience of chasing something, whether it's success, love, money, personal improvement, only to find that when you finally reach it, the feeling of arrival never quite comes? Maybe for a fleeting moment, it seems like you've made it, but then as soon as the dust settles, a new longing emerges, another goal, another craving, another sense that something is still missing, that you are still missing something. And so the cycle continues, stretching out ahead of you endlessly. The next job, the next relationship, the next purchase, the next version of yourself that finally will feel complete. Capitalism knows this feeling well. In fact, it doesn't just know it, it depends on it. Our entire system is structured around manufacturing and maintaining this feeling of lack. It's not just that capitalism exploits our labor, and it certainly does, but it also exploits desire itself. It convinces us that we can finally get whole if we just consume enough, work hard enough, own enough, optimize enough. And yet, the more we chase, the more the goalpost moves. The more we consume, the hungrier we become. The more we seek satisfaction, the more dissatisfied we are. Because in the end, capitalism doesn't just fail to provide fulfillment, it requires our unfulfillment to sustain itself. At the heart of this is a deep, often hidden paradox. We are not actually suffering from a lack of resources necessarily, but from an excess of production, an excess of commodities, an excess of choices that never bring resolution. Capitalism thrives not on scarcity, but actually on abundance. An abundance designed to keep us endlessly dissatisfied. We are surrounded by an obscene excess of wealth, information, entertainment, branding, self-help, promises of success, yet we are more alienated, anxious, and existentially hungry than ever before. Why? Because excess does not resolve lack. It intensifies it. And the system makes sure that we remain personally invested in this particular trap. We're told that if we're still feeling unfulfilled, then it must be our fault. We must not be hustling hard enough, healing fast enough, meditating right, buying the right things, choosing the right brand of self-optimization. And when none of it works, capitalism simply offers us more. Another distraction, another product, another dopamine hit, to keep us from noticing that the system was never meant to satisfy us in the first place. And it's not just in our consumption habits. This structure extends to our media, our technology, and our politics. Look at the films we watch, franchises that never end, stories that refuse finality, characters who can never truly die. Marvel movies, corporate reboots, endless sequels. Capitalism cannot tolerate endings. It cannot tolerate real loss. It cannot tolerate lack. Everything must continue indefinitely because if we ever actually arrived at satisfaction, we might just stop consuming. The death of a character, the conclusion of a story, the finality of an experience, these things force us to confront the limits of life itself, and capitalism cannot allow that confrontation. For too long, the left has focused on capitalism primarily as an economic system, one of exploitation, wage labor, class struggle. And it absolutely is, don't get me wrong. But what Todd McGowan's work forces us to confront is that capitalism is not just a system of labor extraction, it's a system of desire extraction. It doesn't just produce commodities, it produces subjects who are trapped in an endless cycle of wanting, consuming, and never arriving. It creates a form of consciousness that cannot imagine desire outside of accumulation, that cannot envision enjoyment beyond consumption. And that is why breaking free of capitalism is not just a political and economic struggle, though it is primarily that, but it is also a psychological and existential one. This is why I always point to the necessity of inner transformation alongside outer transformation. It's not enough to just redistribute resources or seize the means of production, though that would be a good start. But if we don't address how capitalism has shaped our very way of desiring, we will be doomed to replicate in one form or another its logic, even in a post-capitalist world. This is why, alongside materialist analysis and revolutionary praxis, which are essential, I emphasize the importance of deep internal transformation, one that allows us to relate to desire, to lack, and to enjoyment in a way that capitalism does not structure for us. And for me, one of the clearest and most effective ways to engage in that inner transformation is through Buddhist meditation and contemplative practice. Buddhism, particularly its critique of attachment and craving, goes directly to the root of this problem. It teaches that our suffering does not come from lack itself, but from the illusion that lack can be erased. The endless cycle of desire, what Buddhism calls samsara, is eerily similar to capitalism's cycle of excess, dissatisfaction, and the perpetual deferral of fulfillment. Just as McGowan argues that capitalism convinces us that one more purchase, one more upgrade, one more goal will finally bring satisfaction, Buddhism shows us that the craving mind is never satisfied, not because we are failing, but because that is the nature of craving itself. True liberation doesn't come from satisfying every desire. It comes from changing our relationship to desire. It comes from learning to sit with lack rather than compulsively filling it with more. And if we can do that, if we can practice that and integrate that wisdom into our daily lives, then our very being, our very presence can stand as a bulwark against what capitalism is selling us. Instead of only opposing capitalism intellectually while still engaging in its logic, we can extract ourselves from it at the deepest levels of our psychology. After all, what product could capitalism possibly sell to the Buddha? What marketing scheme would work on Jesus? What fashion trend could convince St. Francis to take off his robes and put on a Gucci belt? The whole premise of capitalism becomes laughable to a truly spiritual person, and not the pop, new age spirituality of Instagram influencers, not the kind of spirituality that wants to sell you a course or a meditation cushion or a crystal or an app. Rather, the kind of spirituality that extracts you from that whole carnival of desire and consumption. The sort of spirituality where sitting in the grass and listening to the birds gives you everything you could ever need in that moment. So today, we're going to dive into this head on. Joining me again is Todd McGowan, whose latest book, Pure Excess, Capitalism and the Commodity, explores the deep psychoanalytic logic of capitalism, the way it shapes our relationship to desire, lack, and to enjoyment itself. We'll be talking about why capitalism cannot function without excess, how it manufactures our dissatisfaction, and what it would mean to truly break out of the system, not just structurally and materially, but also subjectively, psychologically, at the level of how we experience life itself. But before we get into that, if you like what we do here at Rev Left Radio, you can support us on patreon.com/RevLeftRadio. In exchange for your support, $5 a month, you get access to bonus monthly episodes every single month and a back catalog now of over 300 bonus Patreon episodes over the last 8 or so years we've been on the air. And if you don't want to get on Patreon, you don't want to do a monthly membership, you just want to support the show with a one-time donation, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/RevLeftRadio. The links to both of those things would be in the show notes. This show is 100% listener funded. We deeply appreciate everybody who supports the show in any way they can. And if you don't have money, that's totally fine. Sharing these episodes, leaving us a positive review, anything like that also helps the show grow and gets the show in front of more eyes. So thank you to everybody who supports the show in any way they can. And without further ado, here's my conversation with Todd McGowan on his newest book, Pure Excess, Capitalism and the Commodity.
So I'm Todd McGowan. I teach theory and film at the University of Vermont. I've written books like Pure Excess, Embracing Alienation, Capitalism and Desire, and a book on Hegel. So that's kind of who I am. I'm the co-host of the podcast Why Theory that some people listen to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great to be here.
great to have you back on. I'm a fan of Y Theory for sure, and I think the first time you ever came on the show was in 2019. So this is our fourth show together in 2025. So always a pleasure, always an honor to have you on. You're one of my favorite guests. You're a fan favorite. And I really, really am excited to talk to you about this newest book of yours, Pure Excess, Capitalism, and the Commodity. I just think all your work is a really important angle on a fully fleshed out sort of critique of capitalism, and from an angle that oftentimes Marxists themselves don't really engage with in a serious way, I think to their own analytical detriment. But let's just go ahead and get into it. So the book's title, Pure Excess, suggests that capitalism is not merely about profit or even scarcity, but about excess itself. Can you kind of explain this concept, especially for listeners unfamiliar with psychoanalysis, and how it differs maybe from a traditional Marxist critique of capitalism?
Yeah, so in a way, I think this is the book that I've written that's the most Marxist, because this idea of pure excess really, I think, stems ultimately, its ultimate origin is the Marxian notion of surplus value. But yeah, the psychoanalytic twist on that is that, so for psychoanalysis, excess is always tied to lack. So we, because we're lacking subjects, because we're desiring subjects, there's a paradox or an irony of it that it ends up making us excessive about things. Like we get excessively attached to certain objects. We get, and I'm sure this I think is one way to think about addiction, but even not addiction, like any cherished object we have an excessive attachment to it. So if we weren't, the idea is that if we weren't lacking desiring subjects, we wouldn't develop these excessive attachments. And so the idea is that for psychoanalysis, our lack is inextricably tied to our excess. So there's no, there's no pure excess. And the way of thinking about capitalism that I try to develop in this book is that, well, capitalism actually it proffers this fantasy of pure excess, this idea of an excess without any lack attached to it. So there's a certain incompatibility between psychoanalysis and capitalism. So that's the basic idea, and I think that, and again, I think that the roots of that idea are certainly in the Grundrisse and in Capital.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you that this is a very Marxist book of yours in that sense. And this kind of relates, before we move on to the next question, to kind of the idea of overproduction within capitalism, right? There's a psychological and a material component. Can you kind of talk about the overproduction aspect and how that plays into this?
And I think you're right to point out how it's certainly societal, economic, but it's also, I think, psychic, that the real psychic reward or the psychic promise of capital is in the producing too much of something. And also, I think one of the things one of the watchwords of this book is inutility or uselessness. And I think it's really important that the things that capital produces and generates capital from are things that aren't necessary. And so I really play on this idea of in a way that Marx, I don't think, does, because he lived before Freud, play on this idea of use value, that it's really about something that's not, that does, it specifically doesn't have use value. And I've certain Marxist friends of mine have been critical. They're like, you don't really understand what Marx means about use value. I do understand. I'm just trying to say that if we understand use in a different way, not just insofar as it can be that we purchase it, right? But insofar as it's not useful for us, that's really, I think, the key to the commodity and to what is being overproduced, like produced so much that it can't even be used in a way that serves our needs. And I think that's really important, that distinction between what's useful and what's excessive.
Yeah. Do you have like a good example to kind of help touch ground with that with listeners?
I think I use this example in the book, and it's one of my favorite ones, but the way in which people buy specifically Nikes, but just any kind of sneakers. Like, I think that they, people that buy them, they buy, they, a lot of times they update their, they buy, when a new one comes out for the year, they buy that new model. And obviously their shoes haven't worn out. They don't need the new model. And oftentimes they don't even wear the new model, and, or they wait to wear it, but, or they wear it and they keep the old one that's not, that hasn't been used up. So there's no real need that's being served yet. It seems like it's not a pure excess, but it is just excessive. And I think that that seems to be one of the great examples. I think other times the way people that are wealthier do this with cars, right? Like they get a new car every year, even though their old car is not, it's nowhere near being used up. So I think that those are a couple of the more maybe obvious examples. I mean, clothing is also a thing that if we look at our closets, we have a lot of things that we never would use, and yet we're still buying more stuff. So I feel like those are maybe the most conspicuous ones.
Yeah, I mean, we might get into this a little bit later too, but obviously, like the iPhone, the new one comes out,
virtually nothing
is different, and yet, and your phone works completely fine, and yet if you have enough money, there's an impulse to buy the newest model.
Well, not even, Brett, it's interesting, isn't it? Because not even you have enough money. Like my son's phone actually just, this is very interesting you brought this up, because this happened just about 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. One of my son's phones, it broke, and because we're bad parents, our twins are in college and we're still paying for their phones. Broken, and he goes to get a new one. And they're like, well, it would be cheaper if there's another member of the family that was also getting a new one too. Like, not only is it, I did get a good deal, it's actually cheaper to get two than to get one. So my phone was working totally fine. I liked it. And I had to turn it in, and I'm like, can I still have the little thumb thing? They're like, no, you can't do that anymore. You'll quickly get the hang of the new way, and I'd hate the new thing. So it's not, and I think it's a great indication of how the new and the less useful is just pushed upon us, even though the old thing is no, I mean, the iPhone is the perfect example of this, right? Like, it's just absolutely, like, the new, what are the new features? Mm. The camera has more, I mean, just stuff you just couldn't care less about, right? And it works less well than the other one did. So it's not, there's nothing about the usefulness of it, right? That is creating the new thing. So I think it's, you hit on maybe the example, the ne plus ultra, right? Like, it's the one that's perfect.
And there's this affective dimension to something like buying the newest iPhone as well. When you get it, there's obviously this initial thrill. You're getting it. You can't wait to go into it. You unlock it. There's a part of you that knows that not much has changed, but there's still a little excitement about exploring what might be there. But then very quickly, you bump up against the limitations of it, and that swelling of excitement fades away, and now you just have this, you know, this thing that is just like the last thing. But your attempt to satisfy that itch is very, very short lived. And we've now experienced it through many, many models. And yet we continue to kind of fall prey to that every time.
People keep doing it. Yeah, I think it's exactly right. And I think that what you're talking about there is what I try to talk about in the book, like this movement from, like, your expectation is that the excess will be pure. And then when you get the thing, and it takes, like, I don't know how long. It depends on who you are, I guess. Like, 10 minutes. For me, it happens in, like, 10 minutes. But for other people, maybe they get a little bit longer of this, like, the thrill you're talking about. And then it's gone. And so the excess ends up being not pure at all. And that's the point, I think.
Absolutely. Now, before we move forward, I just wanted to kind of zoom out a little bit and say why I find your work so interesting and how it dovetails with mine in an interesting way, because as obviously a Marxist podcast, we're interested in confronting capitalism, transforming the social and the economic and the political revolution, etc. But I've always also pushed this idea that there is an inner subjective and consciousness-oriented way in which capitalism preys on us, and a dimension that we have to overcome if we actually hope to overcome the logic of capitalism externally. And for some more traditional or orthodox Marxists, they see that as unnecessary, as a flourish, as something that is really outside of Marxism proper to address that subjective element of the whole system. But, you know, I usually do it through like the discourse on Buddhism, which we'll get to. You do it through a very sharp psychoanalytic lens. But I think we both agree that that subjective dimension is absolutely crucial, that we must face that as well as confront the external material reality of capitalism sort of simultaneously if we hope to really overcome it.
Yeah, so right. So I was at a screening of No Other Land, you know, this documentary about Palestine, and two nights ago, and they're like, okay, we need to get the main point of this isn't just to watch the documentary, but to get people to sign up to take action. And I'm like, okay, you know, obviously I agree with that. But then what was interesting was, like, that's always the question, right? Like, get people to sign up to make people act. And I think what you're saying, and that this is absolutely totally my view as well. Like, well, what is the real barrier to getting people to taking action to struggling against capital? Well, it's their psychic investment in capital. So, okay, yeah, you can say like, oh, that's just false consciousness. We don't even need to think about that. But I think it's a real barrier. Mm. I mean, I think it manifests itself in every time people are saying, we just need to organize. I always say, yeah, that's true. But like, what is there still is like a tangible barrier to that. And I think it's a psychic one. Mm. And so that's where I'm trying to intervene and have something to say, that it's not like and that's why I think when you intervene, you have to intervene both with some idea of a collective action, obviously, because clearly an individual battle against capital is not going to be a successful one, right? It's too massive. But on the other hand, a collective one's not going to be successful if the individuals invested in it are still invested in the commodity, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it has to be a sort of a war on both fronts, if you will.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that inner aspect, people would say, well, I'm not really invested in the commodity. I want to overthrow capitalism. And they consciously think of themselves as that. But in all these subtle and unconscious ways, they are pulled into the very logic of capital. And so that needs to be brought into a full awareness and then you know, dismantled through interventions like yours and others. If we're really going to address it, you can't just say, well, I'm a socialist. I don't agree with capitalism. Therefore, I'm not really subject to its ideological pull or, you know, subconsciously engaging in its logic. You absolutely are, because we're conditioned.
Well,
in the
I know
society.
While you're watching Netflix and searching
exactly.
on your iPhone. I mean, like,
exactly.
right? Like, it's a, you know, probably simultaneously, which is again also part of the capitalist thing, right?
Absolutely.
Like the way attention is diffused. I think, like, that's so. Yeah, I think I don't think it's. Yeah, I just don't think it's that simple to say like, oh, I'm not a capitalist subject because I'm not. I don't believe in capitalism, right? Mm-hmm. Like. I mean, I'm tempted to say, you know, this, people say this about things all the time, but, you know, you may not believe in capitalism, but it believes in you.
Yeah,
like it,
yeah.
You know, you're invested in it, whether you want to be or not. I think that's one of the things I think that's to me one of the reasons for its incredible persistence.
Mm, mm. Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's go ahead and move on. Capitalism presents itself as a system of rational exchange, but you, alongside Marx, argue that the commodity form is a kind of magic trick, hiding labor and exploitation, but also, according to you, manufacturing desire and sustaining the illusion of infinite novelty, which we just touched on. So how does this deception work, and why do people remain invested in it?
Yeah. So one of the things that I do, and this I think is again a very Marxist example. I talk about this. You mentioned a magic trick. I talk about a real magic trick where the magician makes a bird in a cage disappear, and then has the bird come out of the magician's arm or something, coat or something. And this is incredibly detailed in the Christopher Nolan film, The Prestige, which I think is his masterpiece. But I think that the point is that what's interesting about that is that the I'm sure people know this, that the bird in the cage is crushed when the magician claps the cage down, and it's a different bird that emerges. And I link that crushing of the bird to the crushing of labor by capitalism. And then the bird that emerges is the commodity. And it seems like it's the same bird, so that there's no, we haven't, the sacrifice is not palpable, right? Like you don't register the sacrifice except unconsciously. Obviously you know something happened, that you know, like when you're looking on your iPhone, at least there's some awareness that children were mining cobalt in the Congo, and that things like this that are you don't want to be conscious of, because it would make your enjoyment of the app less pure. But I think that's how, I mean, that's that dimension of like the way in which it's also, it's like there's some, that magic trick is a way to also get your phantasmatic investment in the commodity. Because if you didn't have that, I think you wouldn't be susceptible to the lure of the commodity, which I think is it's interesting. Like how, to what extent would, and this I sort of say this in the book in a speculative way, like to what extent would Marx have been different if he would have read Freud? I mean, he couldn't have read Freud, because Freud hadn't written anything by the time Marx died. But it does make for an interesting question, I think. Like, how would the analysis of the commodity have been different? Because I think the lure of the commodity is really, really important. And I think, you know, when Marx says the commodity is full of all these theological niceties, I think that he doesn't really see the extent to which that's true. Like, it's really, it almost has a theological, religious power over us.
Yeah, it's a really interesting idea, too, to think about Marx engaging with Freud and the psychoanalytic tradition more broadly. And that actually brings up an interesting tension that maybe you could touch on, which is there are obviously attempts in the past to synthesize insights, and you're working in that tradition. But there's also genuine tension, you know, even a lot of the figures within psychoanalysis like Jung and Freud were very conservative, certainly not Marxist.
Sure.
Jung is a hardcore individualist and anti-communist, and there's to this day
Nazi.
I mean yeah,
let's be fair. Yeah.
I mean, in a lot of ways, yeah. So
no, I mean, he was like a pro-Aryan. Like he was not sad that the Nazis took power.
Yeah, because I've heard things with Jung that you know, people try to say that actually he stayed in academia to kind of like help his Jewish colleagues and their work get ahead. What do you make of all that?
Yeah, I just don't think that's true. I don't think that's true. Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
I think a lot of people have a lot of they really have a lot of investment in Jung, and they want to. I get it. You know, and I mean, it's the same thing like this crisis that happened with Heidegger, right? Like people who were invested in him, they felt like they had to defend him until it became evident that you just couldn't. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I guess I've never really seen that problem. Like, I think you can, like a thinker can be valuable, and they can have done pretty bad things. And I don't think that makes their thought necessarily less valuable. So that's not, but what you said, and actually to the point, like you're right, Freud was a conservative. Jacques Lacan was a conservative. Like those guys are conservatives. But I don't think that makes their thought less valuable or less able to be mobilized for a leftist project.
I agree.
Not at all. Not at all. So I just don't think that's, I mean, Freud was a conservative because he was a pessimist. Like he just thought, and I think actually a little pessimism is a good thing for the left, actually.
I agree. I'm kind of interested. That was very interesting in and of itself, but I'm interested in what you think is one of the most credible or the best arguments coming out of a Marxist direct, and that is skeptical of psychoanalysis, and how you would attempt to resolve it, or if you would at all.
Well, I'll just say who my favorite anti-psychoanalytic thinker is. That's Georg Lukács, for sure. Like, I think he's or Jean-Paul Sartre. I think both of them, although Sartre's not really a Marxist, I don't think. But I think Lukács, like, I think he's, what I would say, he's very hostile to psychoanalysis, right? And yet, I think there's certain dimensions of him that are, like, just, here's what I would say. His, and this is why I think Lukács is such an interesting figure, like, his attention to form, I think, is actually one of the points at which psychoanalysis and Marxism come together. And so I get his critique that it's in, that it's all necessarily individualist, and I actually think I don't in terms of a practice, and that it's actually his idea is that it's a and this is a pretty standard Marxist idea that it's accommodating individuals to their to their capitalist situation, mm-hmm. right? But I don't think that's even totally wrong. But I think that the theoretical insights that come along with psychoanalysis actually are part of a challenge to that capitalist system. So I don't some of those critiques I don't have that much disagreement with. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just think it's the only thing I would say is it's that psychoanalysis is not therapy. And I think that's a pretty important distinction, right? So it's not about like therapeutically making you feel healed. Mm. And so making people feel not healed, which I think is the psychoanalytic goal, is pretty consonant with political struggle, I think.
Very interesting. And I think we'll touch on that a little bit going forward. But your general point about taking ideas and core concepts, even from traditions that might even be outwardly hostile to a revolutionary left-wing program, is an important thing that we can and should do. And in fact, my most recent episode was a 2.5 episode on Marcus Aurelius's Stoicism. Marcus
sure.
Aurelius, a Roman Empire, what does he have to teach us 2,000 years later, interested in proletarian revolution, but inverting some of those ideas, taking them and putting them to work in service of a Marxist or a revolutionary program is precisely, I think, more valuable and what we should be doing instead of simply dismissing the whole thing as hostile to Marxism, therefore there's nothing of credibility or nothing of use in there. I think we throw a lot of babies out with a lot of bathwater when we do that.
Couldn't agree more. And I think like that's one of the great lessons of Hegel, right? That it's never just about like dismissing or critiquing, but about like seeing the truth within the thing and then developing that, right? Or seeing how the even the contradictions have something to teach us about a position. I just absolutely agree with that. Like, yeah. I find just the dismissal, and I don't see what's gained by that, really. Yeah. That's why I tend to not to write things or even do things where I'm just attacking a position, because I just don't think it's just not that interesting.
Yeah.
and not that helpful.
And it's often very lazy, and it's a cover.
Yeah,
it's a cover
yeah.
for a refusal to engage.
Yeah. I mean, engage, right? Engage and see what's being said there, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, one of the most interesting arguments of yours, and one that really hit home for me just in my own personal experience, and I think will hit home to a lot of audience members, is that capitalism convinces people that they can get whole if they just consume enough, work hard enough, I might add self-optimize enough, or attain the right status symbols. But the system itself ensures that wholeness is always out of reach, definitionally, structurally. So with this idea in mind, how do debt, commodity fetishism, and ideological illusions sustain this endless, unachievable promise?
Well, I think debt is the big one. I think I start that chapter with, I quote Paul Manafort,
mm-hmm.
and I think I say something like, you know, Paul Manafort probably isn't a good person to look for advice, because even as a corrupt guy, he's not really that good at corruption. I guess he wrote to this guy he was helping him. He's like, how do I use to get whole? That is, use his position in the Trump campaign to get whole. And I just took that as a, and I mentioned this in the book. My grandfather was a great gambler, and he. Not a great gambler, a bad gambler, a gambling addict. And he was constantly on the phone to his bookie. And I heard him say it all the time. Well, how can I get whole here? And I thought, it's really interesting the way debt functions, right? Like the main problem with debt isn't that you're in debt, that you owe money. It's that it fosters this psychic illusion that you can, if you just pay back the debt, you can get whole. And I think I think that idea of wholeness is really integral to the way that capitalism functions. And that's why, for me, seeing the necessity of self-division and contradiction and alienation, failure of wholeness, is really part of the way that you confront that system. So even if you, obviously, the point would be, even if you pay off your debts, you're still going to be desiring, lacking, being, not a whole being. So I think that that's, yeah, that's like the, to me, that's one of the main ways. I have to say that was the first thing in this book that I wrote. And I felt like, God, that I really kind of have to fit that in something, because I think it's such a powerful, like debt is so omnipresent, right? Like capital can't survive without debt, and it's obviously increasing and increasing, and I felt like I needed to talk about that. And so, and I think that's, it's easy to talk about the economic role that debt plays, but I wanted to get into the psychic role that it played in, and the way it promulgates this idea of wholeness.
Yeah. And there's not even, I mean, there's consumer debt, of course, but the debt aspects of American life, where to get an education, yeah, to get medical, I have deep debt, and it's just because I had the gall to not be rich and try to go to school, and then I had the gall, right, to try to get medical help without having good insurance or whatever, any insurance. And so medical debt is the number one cause of bankruptcy.
It's a killer.
Oh, my God.
It's a killer,
yeah.
Brett. Yeah. Yeah,
so it's just brutal how that whole aspect of your analysis here is also tied into people's like ability to, like, you know, because in capitalism you need to advance. You're told, like, if you don't, right, you know, get this degree and keep moving and keep getting more credentials and getting more skills, you're going to be shitty on the job market. Nobody's going to want to hire you. So then to go after that goal, then you have to go into debt. And it's just like this horrific spiral that really feeds off each other, but is really indicative of your point here that there is, it's actually impossible to get whole, to finally reach a,
right, exactly,
an end point.
Exactly.
But yeah. But you're chasing,
yeah, and
that
also
whole time.
The way that debt, just what you're talking about, the way that debt is absolutely crucial to sustaining the system, right? Mm-hmm. Like all the profit for capitalism is profit off the future, right? Because there's not enough in the present to keep things constantly growing. So it has to be borrowed from the future. And so it's really interesting how people have to be pushed to this position of like in getting more debt. And if interestingly, I think if you stay out of debt, like don't you think it's fascinating? Like if you're one of these people that pay your credit cards off every month, you're actually like, you're the parasite. Because you're getting a discount on everything that you buy and everything you do. You're able to use your credit card. You maybe even get a cash back at the end of the year, right? Mm-hmm. But you're doing it because there's all these other people, most users, that are paying interest and are in debt, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a really, I mean, I think it's like a reversal. The way capitalism works, it's a reversal of the way we see the parasite. The parasite isn't the person that's in debt and relying on on other people's money. The parasite is the person who pays off their debts, yeah, and are surviving on the basis of the people who are indebted. And I think the same thing is true in capital, actually. Like it's the big companies that rely on everybody being in debt that keep things going. And the parasitical, and this is a terrible thing to say, but the parasitical firms are the little like corner stores that, you know, people pay cash because they're not the ones that keep the capitalist system going. It's the huge conglomerates, right?
Yeah, it's super finance. Interesting. Yeah. One more thing I think about, even in, specifically in regards to like just consumer debt, you know, you want a new couch, you want a new table, but you know, you're working class. Something that I feel is like even with me and my wife, sometimes we do this, like we buy a couch and then we pay off the debt because we have to finance the couch or whatever. And then so, you know, the horizon of paying off the debt is there. And then there's that feeling of satisfaction, like we have no more debt. But the first thing we do is say, we need a new dining table.
I know,
so
exactly.
Let's get back into debt.
I know.
We have to clear this debt so we can go into another form of debt.
I know. That's what we do too. We're like, okay, all right. So which debt are we going to choose this time? Right? Like, yeah. Because this one's terrible. Though, you know, this thing needs to be replaced. But it's all like a question of that, right? Like it's, yeah. Absolutely. But it's not a question of not going into debt, I think.
Yeah. So this is another aspect of the getting whole part that I wanted to kind of touch on, and
yeah,
is this is kind of the irony of the system is the people who succeed most at capitalism, right? It's so clear, like you can think of Trump and Elon because they're in the news right now and in front of everybody's face. It is so clear that no matter how much wealth they have, no much how much power they have, no matter how much they've quote unquote won the capitalist game, that they are also never, ever, ever satisfied. They need more. They need to be liked. They need the attention. And this is another aspect, is like, even the billionaires, even the quote unquote winners of capitalism, they think that by getting that power and that wealth and that legacy, that they will somehow be ultimately satisfied. But even at the very pinnacle of the capitalist pyramid, are deeply unsatisfied, kind of pathological people, you know, that can never quite get there. And I wonder if you can touch on that a little bit.
Yeah. In fact, I think it's like, maybe I even used this example in the book, but it's like in The Great Gatsby, like that green light at the end of Daisy's dock that recedes the closer that you get to it. Like, I feel like it's actually like compared to you and me, I think their situation is, I mean, obviously they have more creature comforts than we do, but their situation's worse, because the closer that you get to that pure excess, the further it seems to recede away from you. And so I feel like that's the whole point of the way that ideological structure functions, that the closer you get to it, the more you feel like, I don't have it really. And so I got to do more and more and more and more. And so that's why, like Musk, he's just bragging about working 100 hours a week. So what is he working for? Like, what is the point of that? Right. I mean, it's a strange kind of thing where, and it's very different. And this is, I think, shows the historical nature of the system, right? In a very Marxist way, because like an aristocrat in the, I don't know, 14th century wouldn't have bragged about how much they were working. Mm-hmm. You know, that would have been ridiculous. They would have bragged about how much they weren't working. And I think it's because there's this absolute striving to get like I gotta work to get the most possible value that I can, right? The most, because I need to strip this excess of its impurities, because it still has some impurities. I want the pure, and then they never are going to get there. And so the closer it seems you get there, the further away you are. So I feel like actually you and me are probably psychically, I mean, I know this is true, we're a lot better off than the people that are in their position psychically, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you can even see it with figures like Peter Thiel or whatever, where it's like, obviously you've won everything, but like they also want to be now the philosopher kings. They want to pretend like they understand Plato, and they want to take their rightful position under the Curtis Yarvin ideology of this aristocratic corporate class. It's never like, you already have all the corrupted democratic quote unquote power by infiltrating that system and buying politicians. Yeah. You already have all the money you could ever want or spend in several lifetimes. And you also need to be worshipped now. It's like, and even if we started worshipping you, it wouldn't be enough.
Is really interesting. You know, I was on this, some guy made a mistake. He's a pro-capitalist guy, and he saw my book called Capitalism and Desire, and he thought it was a pro-capitalist book. And I'm like, you don't want me on there. It's not, I'm not. And he's like, no. I'm open to things. And so the whole thing was just basically an argument the whole time. But what the one thing I thought was really funny was he had an interpretation of Plato's allegory of the cave. And he's like, well, see, here's what's happening. The philosopher goes up and he's like the wealthy person, and he sees in the sun, he sees gold, and he brings it down to everyone, all these workers who are enchained. And he says, look, come up, you can have gold too. And I'm like, wow. I said, So I said, have you read the rest of he didn't answer this question. I'm like, you know, if you read the rest of the Republic, it's not really, it's more of like a communist book, actually. It's about a collective. It's not really about individuals striving. And it's certainly not about the accumulation of wealth. He said, Plato, that wouldn't make any sense to him. He's like, no, every society was about the accumulation of wealth. It's all, every society is about wanting more and more and more. And so it was just fascinating that he wanted to be the expert on Plato's allegory of the cave. And I said to him, look, you can have your people, you can have like Ayn Rand and you know, Friedrich Hayek, and but like leave us Plato because yeah. like he's on our side.
So, absolutely.
But he wasn't going to do that. It was just interesting. I think it just proves your point, right? That there's not like nothing's off limits. Like it's just I gotta conquer all these new worlds, mm-hmm. right?
I love to see him in a bookstore when he comes across Marxist Capital. He'd be like, oh, this is interesting.
Yeah.
All right, let's go ahead and move on.
He'd probably try to invite Marx onto his show.
The grind set, hustle culture yeah. show. So let's move forward a little bit. And this is kind of fun and I think culturally very relevant to everybody who's just exhausted by this. But from endless Coke variations, Diet Coke, Zero Coke, vanilla, sure. cherry, orange vanilla, to mind-numbing Marvel movie reboots, capitalism thrives on perpetual reinvention, repackaging the old as something new, which we see in modern film and TV a lot. You know, endless remakes, endless sequels, retreading the same ground over and over and over again, but always kind of presenting it as new. Is capitalism even capable of functioning without this illusion of the new? And do you think there's a breaking point where people start to see through, like I said, this rather exhausting cycle?
Yeah, I think that your suggestion is correct, that capitalism cannot function without the new. Because I think if someone just said to you, if their advertisement for this new Captain America movie was retread... it's just basically the same story, some new characters, but it's all the same basically. Please come see it. No one would come, no one would go see it, right? Even though I mean, almost no one did go see it. But I do think I think you're that note, that sanguine note. I think that you had in your question. I tend to agree with it. That I think there's a whole danger of a worldwide fascist turn that it would obviate this, but I do think that there is some sense of like, for instance, about the phone, my students are all, they said, I hate my phone, right? They just hate it, but they can't get rid of it and they can't stop looking at it. But they're the affect that they have is hatred. Mm. And I think the lack of people going to the movies, which is sad to me because I still go to the movies. It reflects this, what you're talking about. So I do think there is a kind of saturation point. And I think there's also interesting in lying behind your question, I think, is there some way in which genuine novelty and capital are anathema? And I think certainly genuine aesthetic novelty and capital are anathema. I think that's true. So it's interesting. It's a time to live in, for sure.
Can you go deeper on that aesthetic point? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, again? Yeah. I think that it's not an accident that capital is trying to recycle, say, Marvel things or whatever. But and I think that, like, so let's take a film of we'll talk about a guy that just died. So Gene Hackman, his greatest film. I think it's the greatest film of the second half of the 20th century. Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation. Well. It's a film of incredible novelty, and people didn't really go see it. It was nominated for Academy Award, but another Coppola film, Godfather 2, won because it couldn't be registered, right? Like it just can't. I think that's true of any genuine aesthetic novelty, like Citizen Kane. It's true of like it couldn't. It was basically a bomb because it couldn't, and Hollywood tried to suppress it because it's so challenged. It did a lot of things new, and it so challenged the ways of the fetish. And I think what the fetish does is I think what you're talking about is really fetishism. That fetishism gives us it covers over a lack, and I think lack is where the genuine new emerges. Like there's some kind of rupture, there's something contradictory, there's something that doesn't work, and that's how something new can emerge. But the fetish is constantly covering that over, and I feel like that's what we're getting, these fetishistic fetishizing commodities, and that's why there's some kind of incompatibility between the new and capital.
I have two questions to follow up there. One is sure. just in the psychoanalytic tradition, where does lack come from?
Well, lack comes from it's a good question. Like it comes from this. It's basically theorized first by Jacques Lacan, but it's certainly present in Freud from the beginning, and his name for it was castration, and that just means for him that we're cut off. In a way, it's tied to everything we've been talking about. It just means that we're cut off from any kind of ultimate enjoyment, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's what lack means, that we're cut off from that. Not because, and I think this is often the way Freud is misunderstood, not because we once had it, we once had this plenitude of the breast and then it was taken away from us. No, but because it's precisely being that act of being cut off that creates us as subjects, that it's desire that makes us subjects. And so that desire and lack are basically, they're the same thing. So without that, we wouldn't exist as subjects. So that's where it comes from. Like this idea of like another synonym of it is castration, but castration for Freud and for Lacan is not literal castration. It means that it just means you're cut off from the ultimate satisfaction that you imagine, but doesn't have any actual existence.
And it's never existed.
Never existed, right. And this is a very interesting thing. So Freud has this very fascinating discussion in a very early work called The Project for a Scientific Psychology. He never published it. But he develops this idea that Lacan would really really work out further of Nachträglichkeit or retroactivity. And the idea is that a thing comes into existence insofar as it's lost. Right. Like so that ultimate enjoyment, it's only insofar as we have lost it that it actually once did exist. Right. So it never existed. Mm. It just we kind of lose it into existence, you might say. And I think that's how all nostalgia functions. Right. Like I have this nostalgia for my childhood. But when I was in my childhood, it was pretty miserable.
Yes, yes.
And so it's only because I've lost it that retroactively it's acquired the status of, oh God, it was so great. I was playing in the backyard and it was, but that was terrible. So I think that it wasn't that terrible. It was fine,
sure.
But it just wasn't this site of ultimate enjoyment that I nostalgically turn it into.
I always think of that in the context of reactionaries mythologized past. Like they're so miserable with whatever modernity, and they think that there's, if I could just go back to this time, I would be satisfied, and I would love to just run the experiment. Put them back in the fucking 50s and watch their same pathologies and neuroses be
right,
present.
Exactly, yeah. Man. Exactly. I think that's really true. And I think like you could, I've heard people say this and it's right. Like, okay, make America great again. What time is exactly do you want to return to?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like even like, and people rightly say, like, well, if America in the 20s wasn't so great if you were black, et cetera, or poor. But even for the people that were well off, it wasn't so great, right? Like, I think there's a just like what you're saying, like, you put the people back in that epoch, and they're not going to, like if you put Trump back in the epoch, like, he loves William McKinley, right? Like, mm-hmm. You put him back in the epoch of McKinley, is there running water? I mean, that he has easy, like there's not showers, that's for sure. So there's a lot of things that you would miss.
Absolutely. So, and the people that were closest to, like, let's say a reactionary today, the people that were reactionary in the 50s were bitching about the progress of the 50s and wanting to go back to the 1800s,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
It never
exactly.
ends.
I mean, that kind of right-wing populism, reactionary movement, fascistic movement. I mean, I think that is coincident with capital. Mm-hmm. I think it's I think you can't have capitalism without that as this constant accompaniment to it. Precisely because this capitalist fantasy can't come true. So then you're like, why isn't it coming true? Well, it must have been true once before. So I'm going to go back to that.
Right. Yeah, and then there's that tension where capitalism is always seeking the new, it's always sort of revolutionizing things, it's homogenizing, it's destroying cultures and tradition. And then the conservatives and the reactionaries in capitalist societies are always in tension with that, but they never put their finger on capitalism itself as the thing doing it. So they're kind of in a reactionary way defending the hierarchies of capitalism, while in like a subconscious way contending with the fact that everything you say you believe in, like tradition and stability and patriarchy, is actually kind of being overturned and tumulted and thrown up in the air by the very processes of capitalism itself, which needs those processes to continue on and survive.
Yeah, that's a great, great point. I think like tumult used as a verb. That's pretty great. but I think like, I mean, it's kind of Marx one. It's like Communist Manifesto, right? Like all its solid mouths melts into air, right? Like I think that like, okay, yeah, I'm against these like traditions being uprooted too. Like let's attack capital for that. I mean, I'm not necessarily, but you know, yeah. It is interesting that like what they're really on about, what they're really upset about is precisely capital. Mm-hmm. Right. Like when you think about like the way that people are upset about like conservatives today, like are upset about like transitioning and trans and like surgeries and all this stuff. Like, why is that available to people? It's available because of the development of capital. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, people transition to some extent all throughout human history. Right. But the widespread medically available transitioning, like mm-hmm. that's a product of capital, and it's a bunch of capitalists who are selling it, right? So they're the thing that they're upset about is the very system that they're defending. So exactly. You're right. I mean, that is to me one of the incredible contradictions of reactionaries today. You know, like the things that they are most riled about are the things that are directly due to the development of capital.
Exactly.
I just think it's just such a great point by you.
Yeah, and great addition to you. And there's a million examples of that. And the second part of this follow up, though, on the endless Coke variations in the Marvel movies, and I'm really interested in your take on this, especially with regards to film, is there seems like there, even though obviously the 70s and the 60s and the 80s were very capitalist times in the U.S., there seemed to be more dynamism in the cultural production. That it has sort of ceased now, that there's something culturally shifted, even though we're still living under capitalism, where all these remakes and, you know, these sequels, it's just so it lacks so much imagination that even during other times in American capitalism in the last 75 years, they had much more dynamism in their artistic creation. So what do you think accounts for that? And is there anything like maybe we're entering a terminal or a late capitalist phase or I don't know. There's lots of different directions you can take it, but how do you make sense of that?
Yeah, I just want to say one thing in support of what you're saying. Like as recently, this is 26 years ago, as recently as 1999, it was the greatest year in the history of cinema. It can't even be debated, right? Like I could sit here and list 30 films that were better in that year than The Matrix, which we think of, like if The Matrix came out now, we think like, oh, it's the best film of the year by far. There's not even anything could compete with it. Yeah. So that's the 26 years ago. And so you're exactly like the kind of cultural decline that we, at least in cinema, I think it's true in popular music as well and other artistic forms that we're witnessing is just incredible. And I think it's not just confined to the U.S. either. I think it's worldwide. Although what's interesting to me is where the exceptions are, because I think Iran is one exception, which is a little bit interesting, right? Because it suggests that maybe the tension with that fundamentalist regime is producing a kind of art. And then South Korea is the other place that's a site for the film that everybody will know, Parasite, but. Like I just encourage people to, there's like 30 other South Korean films of the 21st century that are better than Parasite, including like 5 by that same director. So, but I think your point in general is absolutely right. And I think the question is, are we entering some kind of terminal phase? I don't know about that, but I do think that without that production of, I don't know how else to put it, but of works that are interesting, that works that capture people, that works that challenge people, then it does seem like it's harder to get people invested in the capitalist system. Like even all the stuff that people can stream, like, I don't think it excites them to consume in a way that things used to. So I do think that there is a for instance, like, was it February 20th, 2 days ago, right? This don't buy anything day, right? Like, yeah. I wonder if that, which I did obey, I was really hungry and at night and I wanted to go get some to eat, but we didn't have hardly anything in the house, but I did manage to obey and just ate a few stale cookies. But I was very sad, but I felt like I did my duty. But I think, I wonder if that's not going to be emerging as a kind of a thing, right? Because like signing off of all streaming services, and I wonder about that. Like, I wonder if that isn't like, if, in other words, if like Marvel certainly is, you mentioned Marvel a couple times, rightfully, they're certainly feeling the loss, mm-hmm. right? Like they're like, they have not, since the second Avengers film, or the Avengers finale, they have not had a real successful, I guess Deadpool and Wolverine, but that's not really a Marvel thing. They haven't had a real hit. And so I feel like there is some kind of sense that maybe things are winding down for capital, right?
Yeah,
but that leaves open the question of where it goes. I think, right. Sadly, right?
Yeah, I mean, it could go in a few different directions. Obviously,
right.
there could
right.
be revolutionary movements. There could be a techno dystopian authoritarian fascism that emerges out of it, or there could be, as we've seen in the past, a period of capitalist rejuvenation. Where right. there is this adaptability inherent in capitalism. It's come out of the gutters many times before, created new epochs or generations of cultural production and economic growth. But it feels like that trick that it can pull out of its sleeve is not working as much as it used to. So I'm very interested to see where that goes.
Yeah, I'm very interested too. I mean, I know that so a friend of mine, Jody Dean, and I know like Yannis Varoufakis, like they're really into this idea of techno-feudalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I get it. I see why they're saying that. And maybe that will be the future regime. But I think I think that's sort of looking into the future, right? Like my feeling is we're still in a capitalist regime. I think it's more and more an authoritarian kind of capitalism. Mm. But I wouldn't call it yet feudalism, just because the way in which, like, I don't think feudalism depended, its lifeblood wasn't the commodity.
Right.
And I think that's how Marx defines capitalism. And I think I define it that way too, that it's the rule of the commodity form. And I think if you don't, I don't see how, in fact, I think that that's even more true today than it was in the epoch of Marx. So I'm a little reluctant to make this move to techno-feudalism or some kind of new neo-feudalism.
I think that's a really great point, and I agree wholeheartedly. And actually, I push back explicitly on the idea that even when I use the term techno-feudalism, I'm actually not pointing to a shift in the mode of production. I'm trying to use a literary flourish to point out a certain phase in capitalist degeneration, you know?
Yeah.
But it's still firmly capitalist. The super, I would call it a superstructural malaise.
Yeah, that's good.
That's occurring
right
now.
I think that's nice, I think. I like that a lot.
And in South Korea is a brutal capitalist, deeply unequal society as well. But, you know, and then like taken over by these huge corporations and massive poverty. And a lot of the cultural production coming out of South Korea is anti-capitalist in form.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, right. And about the Iranian films, it's hard to say. I mean, it is that in more indirectly, but in Korea, it absolutely is. Mm. Absolutely. For sure.
All right. Well, let's go on to the next question here. You argue that capitalism cannot tolerate real stakes, real endings, or real loss, that even mass culture reflects this by endlessly resurrecting dead characters and refusing finality. I also get a sense of this in how the system as a whole, as we were just talking about, kind of seems to be reaching its own limits, not only ecologically, but also in its inability to kind of constrain itself and its rabidity in the form of Trump and Elon sort of hitting the accelerationist gas pedal in its direct confrontation with democracy itself, no longer able to ideologically conceal its outward disdain for it, and in the fact that people living under capitalism are living worse and worse lives materially and psychologically. So How does all of this relate to the death drive, which is one of my favorite concepts out of psychoanalysis? And what does it tell us about capitalism's fear of limits?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite concepts, too, that I think that so here's what I'd say, that I think capitalism, like every system, has to rely on the death drive, because death drive is the engine that gets us going through the day, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're driven unconsciously to repeat traumatic events, right? We're to repeat loss, and even though there is this fantasy of overcoming lack and loss for good in capital, I think nonetheless, the more you do that, the more you engage in this repetition, and that's what we see all the time. So, but here's the thing: I think it cannot be avowed, right? Like that, like just like you're saying, like loss cannot be avowed. Like, you just have to look at this most recent horrible Deadpool Wolverine example. Like, Wolverine was dead and buried. He wasn't being, so they went to a multiverse and resurrected him, right? And so it was just it's just horrible, because, and I think you mentioned the word stakes. Like, you can't, it's interesting, because in capitalism, it's life and death stakes for everybody that's working at a job, right? Like, at any moment that you could do something that offends the powers that be, and you're out on the street, and then how long is it till you're on the corner asking people for anything helps, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I think we all feel that. And but I don't think capitalism can never tolerate real stakes, at least aesthetically, right? Like, it can't, there's never can be this moment where, like, okay, like this is lost for good. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think the climate situation, we've now, I think collectively, we've just decided on, we're just in for disavowal 100%, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're not even going to purport to address it.
Yeah.
Right. That's just out. And I think, like, obviously the U.S. is leading the way with Trump as the great denier, but I think the rest of the world now, it's really fascinating, has kind of said, okay, I guess we're just giving up that. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's except China, maybe, which is a scary kind of prospect, but yeah, maybe.
Yeah, there's also the taking off of any pretense to guardrails with regards to AI. Who knows how that will actually turn out, that's a bubble
exactly.
or not. But there's an accelerationist idea there. Could you give us an example of the death drive maybe in daily life? And do you see that resignation from even attempting to pretend to want to face climate change as a form of civilizational death drive in some sense?
For sure. Because, I mean, there's an interesting way that fetishistic disavowal and death drive function together, and so the denial of climate change is the thing that allows the death drive to keep working. But I just a perfect example from my own life. So I used to run just as a way to eat a lot of cake and stuff that was bad for me, and so ostensibly you're running to stay healthy, but I would run no matter how I felt. And so I was getting a little sick, and I kept running. And then I went for a run while I was really feeling bad. And I damaged my lungs terribly. And I because I had such severe pneumonia, my heart rate was up to 200 resting. Like, I was near death. And I was drawn on. And what's interesting is I thought it was for my pleasure, right? So I could have in these nice pieces of cake. But really what was driving me, and I think this is the key thing, is the destructiveness itself. Like, I think we say, like, oh, I like the taste of that thing, or I want to get this other thing. That's why I'm sacrificing myself. But I think that psychoanalytic idea is that other thing is just a lure. That thing that seems like a pleasurable is just a lure. And what you're really getting off on, to put it that way, is the sacrifice itself. That's the idea of death drive, that it's that sacrifice is in a way its own reward. And you see how that's so antithetical to this idea of a pure excess without any sacrifice that capitalism tries to promise us.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I could think of examples in my own life, but I'll just, for the sake of time, urge listeners to kind of think in their own life where the death drive might manifest. Yeah. That's a fascinating self-examination.
Well, just don't you think even in a daily, in just a much more daily way, right? Like, the way that you Like I constantly at work am taking up tasks that are just getting in the way of my free time, my ability to keep writing and reading and doing the things I like to do. Oh, what? Yeah. Why am I doing that? Like, no, there's no one's pressuring me. I'm just keep on doing that, right? Like, I think everyone can think of examples like that where you're just taking on this thing that, well, why did you take that on? Like, why are you doing that? Like, absolutely. It's just no, it's just a pure self-subversion.
Yes, right? Absolutely. Yeah, that hits home for sure. Yeah. One quick point I want to touch on before we get into the last two questions here is I really love your argument, and you don't have to spend too much time on this, but the argument that minimalism has been transformed into another form of excess, this idea that less is more as an aesthetic choice rather than an actual reduction in consumption or even a new way to consume while convincing yourself that you're actually consuming less. But, you know, I've seen this in the way that this actually manifests in people's real lives is like, they'll buy certain furniture, they'll move towards a new aesthetic, and they're telling themselves that they're consuming less and they're getting rid of some things, but at the same time they're also taking on psychologically and oftentimes materially new forms of consumption. So how does can you talk about this, and then does this mean that any rejection of excess under capitalism is doomed to be commodified in this way?
No, I don't think that's true, but I think you can limit yourself in a way that's, I just think the way that, I think you just put it pretty well there, that the way that minimalism gets mobilized is that it stresses the aesthetic, it stresses the new commodities that you're buying. So you've just defeated the point. But I do think that self, I mean, in a way, this is how the book ends, that some kind of self-limitation is the only way that we're psychically prepare ourselves to challenge the capitalist regime. I'm pretty convinced of that. Mm. So I don't think that any kind of self-limitation is immediately going to be co-opted in the way that this minimalism is. But I think that you can definitely see the way. I mean, in fact, I find people that are minimalist mostly annoying because they I'm like, okay, yeah, you're really not challenging the thing in the way that you think you are, and what's more, you're like a campaign slogan for capital. So I find that a little annoying, but I don't think we should dismiss that on the whole.
I totally agree with you, and that's a great segue into these last two questions, which, now that we've kind of understood the problem, and of course this is just an interview, you have to get the book to grapple with the full complexity of this argument, and I highly recommend people do. And as you said, it's not only your most Marxist book, I think it's incredibly accessible as well. So people that might not feel totally comfortable with psychoanalysis, I think, can still find their way in to this text pretty easily, especially coming from a Marxist perspective.
I think I kept the Lacanian jargon into one little teeny footnote that's one sentence long. So I really, really, kind of really tried to do that.
Yeah. But yeah, so these last two questions are going to be, now that we understand the problem, thinking of a way out. So you suggest that art is one of the few places where capitalism's illusions can be exposed. But in an era where everything, including art, is increasingly commodified, do you still believe that art can challenge capitalism's excesses, or has capitalism already absorbed artistic critique into itself? And as a side question, what are your thoughts about, you know, new media, the likes of which you and I engage in? There's certainly a consumptive element and even an excessive one. If I can just understand this system more, if I can just get the right theory, if I can consume more content and knowledge, while also having a real aspect that does attempt to confront and break down capitalist ideology. So I'd love your thoughts on both of those.
Yeah. So I do not believe that art is forever commodified. I think there's always a tension between what I would call a genuine work of art. I know that's probably a contested term, but a genuine work of art and capital. I think they're at odds with each other, and they end up the genuine work of art is always a challenge to capital, and it fits rough. Even if capital tries to capitalize on it, it's also trying to squelch it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we see so much resistance to genuine works of art and this instead desire to produce superhero movies, which I don't think you can make a genuine work of art out of a superhero movie. I know that I just offended probably most of your audience with that, but
not mine,
but or at least half. But So that's what I would say, that I think there's just, I mean, we could just go through history, right? And this is why I think these great works of art often even fail as commodities, right? Like the great F. Scott Fitzgerald died in a drunken stupor because the Great Gatsby failed. I mean, Herman Melville had to stop writing novels because Moby Dick failed. Like these great, great works, they weren't successful commodities. So I feel like that sort of tells you what I think is the real relationship between art and capital or in the commodity. And as far as the other question, I think probably you feel the same way. I'm really of two minds on this question. Mm-hmm. Like, I really feel like, look, so much of this, of new media and social media especially, is distraction and is getting us not to really focus on what we should be focusing on. Yet, at the same time, I feel like I can't tell you how many, I get probably 10, 15 emails a day from people that, a lot of them are not academics, they're just ordinary people, right? That just want to talk about theoretical questions, and most of them are about capitalism and the commodity and questions like that, and its relationship to the psyche. So there are other, I mean, I'm just one person. There's a ton of other, so many other outlets that are really trying to disseminate theoretical knowledge to people that otherwise wouldn't have access to it, mm-hmm. right? And I think I feel like that's such a great thing, because I think this long critique of academic Marxism, right? Like the problem was it was so shut up. The problem wasn't that it was intellectual. The problem was that it was shut up in the institution, in the university. And I feel like now that's not true. Like even the most academic figure, like your work gets just almost de facto. I mean, you have to do some, obviously you have to do things, but it gets out there and gets disseminated. And I think there's much more of an appetite for that. So I feel like that makes me feel like it's a good thing. So I that's not a great answer, because I'm just totally divided about it. Like, I feel like, just like you're saying, like you can just consume, you can turn it into a thing you're consuming. But at the same time, there's this possibility of like getting, broadening certain ideas to a larger audience and getting people engaged in that way, about thinking about their economic situation in a theoretical way. So yeah. I don't know. I feel like it's both things at once. And yeah, that's dialectics, I guess, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I do think on the whole, it's obviously a good thing if you're using whatever platform you have or whatever skill set you have as an artist or you know, as a communicator or whatever, as an academic, whatever. If you're using that to militate in some way against the system, to raise people's consciousness against the system, ultimately, even though there's always going to be a consumptive element within the capitalist mode of production, even with regards to those things, you're still producing something that is of benefit in that it raises people's consciousness. And I get emails all the time.
Brett, what's the alternative?
Exactly.
I mean, the alternative
exactly.
is just to sit in your room and do nothing.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't think that, yeah. Absolutely. Like if you don't want to ever be part of the commodity system, then you're not going to be doing much, right?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah.
All right. So the last question, it's a little wordy. I hope you'll indulge me here, but
sure.
This is a great way to end this conversation. You end the book on the idea that escaping capitalism requires a transformation in how we relate to enjoyment, lack, and sacrifice. If capitalism produces a subject that is always lacking, always wanting, always chasing an unachievable excess, what does a post-capitalist subject look like? What kind of transformation in desire would need to take place for people to genuinely move beyond capitalism's structuring of enjoyment? And as I always force this question on you in one way or another when we talk, do you see Buddhism as offering a way to desire differently, one that could break capitalism's hold over subjectivity and help us imagine a relationship to lack that doesn't trap us in endless accumulation?
Okay, I'm going to answer both these questions in a way that one is probably not going to surprise you. The other one's going to surprise you.
Okay.
So my friend Sheldon George was given a, so he was given a talk, and there must have been 1,000 people in the audience. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but and it was a talk about psychoanalysis and racism. And someone, he's black, and someone, a white person, stood up and said, "What can I do to," and this classic kind of thing, like, even as a group of psychoanalysts, "what could I do to help fight racism?" And he's like, "Well, everybody can do something, first of all." And then he said the thing, it always stuck with me. He just said, "I really have a 3-word answer for you: enjoy your lack." And I think that's what a post-capitalist subject does. Like, it doesn't think like, "Oh, I got to get over this. I got to get over this thing that I'm missing. I got to get around this, overcome this obstacle." Instead, it sees how I'm actually enjoying this thing, the lack itself, or the obstacle itself is integral to my enjoyment, my satisfaction, right? Like, my favorite example of this is we have twin boys that are 20, they just turned 21. So we have, our cars are, you can imagine the condition that they're in, because we don't have a lot of money and we don't, can't afford to fix them every time they get in a little fender bender. So it's embarrassing. Like, when we have guests come here and I got to drive, and they're like, "What? This car is wrecked. Why are you driving it?" But I was driving home. I was playing tennis, I don't know, a year ago or so. And I was at the light, and somebody comes up and hits me from behind, right? And like, bumps, hits me in the bumper, and pretty not, I mean, I didn't get whiplash or anything, but I felt it. I get out of the car and they're like, "Okay, I got to give you my insurance information." I'm like, "You know what? It's a 6-1 half to, this car's already, it's fine." You know, just don't, you don't need to get insurance. Your insurance rate's right. Just drive away. And they're like, "Are you kidding me?" I'm like, "No, I don't want to take this in and get it fixed and just to have it wrecked again." And so I was like, look at the incredible benefit. And they were like, "Oh, thankful." But I was thankful, because I like didn't have to go to the insurance and go to the, right. And so the thing that, and I think this is like a really crucial insight of dialectics, that the thing that is the thing that is the barrier, the obstacle, the damage to the car, is actually this thing that's also it can be freeing too. And I think that's the kind of way of like the realignment to think, like, because I think the capitalist thinks like, "Oh, I got a chance to really get my car repaired," right? Like, that's what they think. So that's that part. Now, the other thing is Buddhism. So I'm going to later today record a Why Theory podcast in which I have to apologize for saying that Buddhism is not that no major authoritarian power has employed Buddhism, unlike all the other major religions. And of course, I received like 10 emails telling me how, what about me and more? And so, okay. So, but I, here's what I think. I think actually religion itself is obviously, even more than art, it gets appropriated by capitalism, right? But I think at the core of religion, and my friend Rick Boothie wrote a book called Embracing the Void, which is about psychoanalysis and religion. And his point is that every religious experience is an experience of this void in the other. And I think Buddhism, it's very clear that that's true in Buddhism. His point is it's also really true in Christianity as well. And that, and the, like the love your enemy injunction is about that. And obviously in Judaism, it's the void is God and the inexplicability of God. And so I feel like that there's something in that that is ultimately incompatible with the logic of the commodity. So I do think that obviously, religious fundamentalism seems like the much more likely path that we're going to go down, which is horrific. But I do think that at the core of the religious experience is this encounter with the void and the other, that I think is tied to what I was just saying about the obstacle and about enjoy or lack. So I'm giving a yes to Buddhism, but I'm not just confining it to Buddhism because that got me in trouble earlier.
No, absolutely. I love the answer. Could not agree more. I just did an episode on Sufism. I talk about Christian mysticism all the time. There is something in the deepest aspects of these religious traditions that is just completely revolutionary subjectively when it comes to the basic logic and premises of capital. So that's a great answer. And the idea of enjoying lack itself, like stop trying to pursue excess. There is no point you'll ever get to in your life where you feel that you've finally arrived. Stop trying to pursue it. And even just something as simple as letting your car be banged up. And not needing to fix it, not needing to go through the rigmarole of trying to get as much as you can out of the other person because it was their fault and you could get more money, and just letting all that go, not buying the next iPhone, all these different ways.
All those things, right.
You're cultivating something within yourself that is
antithetical. And it is a challenge to capital, right? Like that damages the functioning of capital.
Yeah.
In a very small way, but it does. Right.
Yeah.
And it also makes you then able to be part of some collective work.
Exactly. Yeah. If we're going to do the outward transformation of revolutionary organizing in any effective way, we have to take seriously this dimension as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Beautifully said, my friend. And for any listeners out there that might be in Vermont and you want to get in a car crash, look for Todd driving around the streets. He's the most forgiving driver.
I'm driving the beat-up Prius.
I can't miss him. Thank you so much, Todd.
Okay,
I really appreciate
it.
Hey, before I let you go, though, can you just let listeners know where they can find the book and your podcast?
Sure. The book is at Columbia University Press, so if you want to not buy it on Amazon or buy it from some independent bookstore, that'd be great. It's called Pure Excess, Capitalism and the Commodity. And the podcast is Why Theory, and it's available on Spotify, which is interesting. So when Joni Mitchell left Spotify, we went to Spotify. We're not intentionally, but I'm kidding. I think when she went back, we joined, but we ended up having to because the podcast only costs us money. We don't make anything. So the other platform ended up being too expensive. So.
Nice. All right. Well, I'll link to those in the show notes. Thank you so much, Todd. Keep up the amazing work, and let's talk again soon.
Brett, thanks. That'd be great. Take care.
I don't want to work more. I want to work less. I don't want a cold shower to endure what's next. I want to kill my ambition. Disappear into the forest. So when you tell me why I'm wrong, I won't hear it. I need to take a break. I need to hurt less. There's pressure in my throat from too much stress. Take a look around. It makes perfect sense. I'm adversely affected by negative environments. I need to believe, if I scratch and I bleed, I'll find a way, through the unknown, headed for home, someday, play the game they say, pass every test, learn to be a leader, no time for rest. Machines are so smart, they simulate intelligence. They can do my work, let them handle it. I wanna feel good, I wanna feel my best. You tell me not to worry, I'm obsessed. Impossibly unsettled, a panic-stricken mess. I wanna feel secure. Not like this. I need to believe. If I scratch and I bleed, I'll find a way. Through the unknown, headed for home. Someday, running out of time, not much left. Step. The sun may be shining, it's time to get dressed.